history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are stories that need to be told, and sometimes all it takes is for someone to ask a few questions and take the time to listen, and that's what we're going to do today in Madera, California. And we want to make sure that our veterans know that we appreciate their service and sacrifice, that we're not going to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot, we're educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And Madera, California is where Martin Madellan has lived for, well, more than 80 years. And he's only 90 years old, so do the math. Pretty young boy when he came here. Did have a little trip to Europe about 70 years ago that almost claimed his life, but didn't. And we're very thankful for that. He's a recipient of the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart. Didn't get those all during World War II. There's a story there. And he's also a guy that I've been trying to catch up with for a long time. Martin, I know that I've seen you in a lot of places because you've been so active in VFW post 1981 here. You've been a member since 1947. And I know it's not easy for you to talk about what you did during the war. So first of all, thank you for being willing to sit down and share this today. I'm real eager to hear your story. I want to hear about before you came to Madera, though. You're a Lone Star guy. You grew up in Texas?
Yes,
With a pretty big family.
Big family.
How many brothers you have?
Six boys and two girls.
And five of you six boys were in the military?
Five of us, yes.
Who got that started?
My older brother, Jess. Jesse was in the Pacific in Japan, and he was an engineer. And then my second brother, Gilbert, he was a medic in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to go and pick up soldiers and bring them home and wounded ones and dead ones and all that. So then it was me who joined in San Francisco. Then my younger brother, Larry, he went to Korea. And my younger brother, Victor, he's in Navy. He's the only Navy man. The other ones were in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Four in the Army and one in the Navy.
Poor Victor. He is outnumbered. He can never win that argument, can he?
No, he couldn't. Yeah.
So before you moved out here to California, though, as a young boy in Texas, you remember anything about those years?
Well, I remember that we used to be out in the ranch, and my dad was a half owner of the ranch, ran the ranch.
Uh-huh, like a foreman or something?
Yeah, and I used to ride a lot of horses. I used to love to ride the horse. I used to go out and get them out in the field and ride them, and that's what I can remember the most, you know.
What was it that brought your family out here?
Some lady that lived over there close by, her mother lived here in Madera, and she used to tell them that it was just when gold was going on and a lot of work and stuff. And so my dad decided to come and check, and him and one of my older brother, they came on the train, came into Madera, and he went into a ranch, Potros Ranch, in 18 and a half. He got started there, and then he took over running the ranch for Potros. And nothing but cotton and grapes. And then he sent for us. So my older brother Tom, he drove the car in a trailer coming all the way from Dallas. Well, actually, it was 20 miles the other side of Dallas at Kaufman.
Mm.
Kaufman, Texas. And used to be in the ranch out there. So he drove us all the way down to Madera. And we settled here then in 1935.
So you're not even 10 years old yet, but your world just changed a lot. You come all the way out here. It must have been a new world for you here.
Oh, it was. I started school, and I went to the old Howard School in Madera. And it used to be one big room for all the grades, and then they built another new home. And now they got three Howard schools.
But when you started, it was a one-room school.
One-room school.
Uh-huh. So you had all your siblings in the same room with you?
Yeah.
You couldn't get away with anything,
no,
could you?
No, you couldn't. Yeah.
And you mentioned that ranch where your dad was working was growing grapes and cotton. Does that mean you were out there picking cotton?
We picked cotton,
mm-hmm,
and grapes. And that's what made me go to San Francisco. My cousin Johnny and I, we decided we wasn't going to be picking grapes and cotton. So we left My dad gave me a little money, so we went to San Francisco, and we got in there in San Francisco, and then we went to welding school. We passed, then we started working welding in shipyard.
And how old were you at the time?
15, 16. We got a certified welding certificate. We could weld anything in a ship.
You're at the Kaiser shipyards there?
Right.
Building all those Liberty ships?
Yeah. That was in Richmond and ships. And then from there, we moved into South San Francisco at the shipyard there. From there, my cousin Johnny left. He went into the Navy. Then they called me, and I could have gotten a deferment and stayed because I was a certified welder. They called me in the office, and they told me that they could keep me. I didn't have to go. So I said, well, everybody's going, so I'll go.
Mm-hmm.
So I left. So then from there, they took me into Camp Roberts in the Army right there by
Paso Robles.
Paso Robles.
Let me ask you a couple questions about that. So clearly you're part of the war effort before you're ever in the military, but the thing I didn't ask you, because we jumped ahead to you leaving town and getting out of the cotton fields and quitting school and becoming a welder, but somewhere in there, the world changed because America was attacked. Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
I remember in December 7th when they were attacked. Right then, I had this right there. This, you say San Francisco?
You got a tattoo on your right forearm.
Yeah. And I put it in December 7, 1941.
Uh-huh. That's when you got that tattoo?
Yeah.
So you were getting that before you heard about the attack, or as a response to the attack?
In response to the attack. When I went in, they asked me what the Navy, Army, or Marines, and so I took the Army. When I went to Camp Roberts, took my 17-week training, I signed up for the paratroopers. And they asked anybody want to sign up for a paratrooper, so I did sign up for a paratrooper, and they never did call me. They left me there. All my outfit left, and I stayed there. Then I wonder what was going on. So they start bringing in some new recruits, so I even started training them also as a private. Then later on, I got my orders. They shipped me into Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri to join the 70th.
70th Infantry Division.
70th Infantry. They were making up the division to send them over. So when I was there, they finished the division, and then from there, they shipped us to Boston, got the ship, and went into across the ocean. That's when Hitler was really going strong. It had to be stopped, so my outfit was one of the 70s that was there. And from there, it went into war. I know that we used to travel at night on boxcars.
40 and 8.
Yeah, we didn't have the helicopters or nothing like they did now. But when they dropped us off there in Philippsburg, France, I was just a private, so all I did take orders. So we unloaded off, and somebody told the captain where to go. So we got out and caught them on each side of the road, walking at night. And we walk, and come to find out, I guess he found out later on that we were in back of enemy lines. And we started to come back again through the woods, not by the road. When going back, the company got pinned down with machine guns on top of the ridge there, so we all lay down. Then I was a BAR man, so I had a big weapon. The Sergeant Peterson came up to me and said, "Medellin, will you come with me?" Okay, so him and I crawled up to the top of the hill, and where they couldn't see us no more. So then from there, we went on top of the hill to the side of the barn where there's two machine guns there, and they had the company pinned down. So the Sergeant said, "You cover me while I advance to the barn. And when I get close down, I'll motion you to come down." So, yeah, okay. Okay, Sarge. So he took off, and I stayed kneeling behind the tree and just looking. So pretty soon, I got shot. I got left side, bullet went in, and burned my arms up, and knocked me down. All the clothes, had a lot. It was winter time, so it was cold. So we had a lot of clothes. But he knocked me down, and I just hollered. I said, "Pete, I'm hit." So he came back and saw me laying down, so he turned me over and saw my clothes all torn, and he wondered what was wrong, so he turned me over and then cut the rest of my clothes, and come to find out that I had scratch where the bullet went in, and he said, "Well," he said, "that bullet didn't have your name," he said, "it had your initial."
Because it came across your shoulder and your neck.
Yeah.
So it grazed
my
neck.
Yeah.
But didn't get your jugular.
No.
And it was probably less than an inch away from your jugular, I'm guessing.
Right.
So it definitely had your initials.
The pure medic took care of me there, and it was never reported. So then from then on, we motioned the company. We went down there and we mowed him down. After he picked me up, we went down there and he had a machine gun and I had the BAR, so there was about 10, 12 guys in there. We mowed him down. Then he said, okay, we motioned the company. It was all clear. So then they got up, they went into town. Well, Sergeant Peterson went in with them and another sergeant took me and the rest of the platoon the other way. So Sergeant Peterson, that's all I knew him by, Sergeant Peterson, because he was the first sergeant. And he has to be reduced to a tech sergeant so he can lead the troops.
Mm.
He was the first sergeant. He never did have to be there. But anyway, he was a great man. And he got killed right away. And he was the only one that knew that I had been shot.
Right.
And never was reported. See? So anyway, I got the Silver Star for that, but he died. He was a brave man. That's all I can remember about that. But he got killed right away, right after that.
Well, I've got a few questions for you. I want to make sure I understand correctly. This is the very first taste of combat you've ever had? I mean, this is within a day or two of you getting there?
Yeah, right.
You talked about you guys walked, and you probably walked over. They moved you on trains, and then you're marching. But this is the first engagement you've had with the enemy, is the one that earned you the Silver Star.
That's right.
So they've got a machine gun on the high ground, so your guys can't advance, right?
Right.
So everybody is hunkered down, trying not to get shot.
Right.
So what made you two guys do something about it?
Sergeant Peterson went and got me because he knew I had the BAR, and he wanted some power.
Mm-hmm.
So the BAR is a big weapon, and he had a machine gun, a burp gun. So he wanted to go get him so the company could advance. So he was the one that, like I said, made those orders, you know.
Well, what were you thinking, though? I mean, you're a 19-year-old kid who didn't even have to go. You could have stayed there welding ships, and you said, no, I want to go. And now you get there.
I wanted to go. Well, I was 18 then.
Just 18, okay.
Yeah. The kid there asked me what was my main training. I said, well, I hate to tell him. I said, well, it's either kill or be killed. That's what it is. I hate to say that, but that's what it is. During the war.
And there was no practice round. This was the real deal.
Did a real deal.
So you guys are heading up there trying to get in position to take them out.
Right.
And you get hit.
Yeah.
Were you in pain?
No, I really wasn't in pain. It was just scared, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like anybody that tells you wasn't scared, they lie because you know you're scared, you know.
So you're 18 years old. Your whole company is pinned down. You're trying to do something about it. You get shot. But you're still going up toward this position, and then your BAR and Peterson's machine gun are able to take out that machine gun nest.
Yeah, there was two machine guns down in the barn. They were in the barn.
Uh-huh.
And there was two of them in there, two machine guns, and then about 10, 12 guys in there. I guess they were there when we passed by there at night. You know, we went through the road.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't know you're passing them by.
We didn't know we were passing them by, no.
But so now, because the two of you were able to take them out, your company could advance. If you guys hadn't done that, it would have cost some American lives.
It could have.
Maybe quite a few.
Yeah.
Did you realize that at the time?
Well, not at the time, but I do now, you know. But it could have. They could have gotten quite a few.
So welcome to the war, teenager.
Yeah. It was something. It was quite an experience, but it had to be done.
Well, we're thankful you got it done and that you lived to tell us the story. It's time for our first break. If you'd like to find a couple photos and even a short video with this week's guest, Martin Medellin, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 90-year-old Martin Medellin of Madera, California. He served with the 70th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II, later with the 2nd Infantry Division II. He told us about the incident that earned him the Silver Star. He was just 18 years old, but working with Sergeant Elmer T. Peterson, he took out two German machine guns that had pinned down 283 men in Company K of the 275th Infantry Regiment. That was in Philippsburg, France, during early January 1945, as Operation Nordwind, the last major German offensive of the war, added to the more publicized encounters north of there during the Battle of the Bulge. So, Martin, that was your first real taste of combat, but you still had 4 months to go. Where'd you guys go from there?
From there, we went to towards Saarbrücken. One time it was our company, Company K and L Company, we were fighting each other. So they were up on top of the hill, and we were going in towards Saarbrücken and going to take that. They had the orders. They start fighting there from the mountain. They were on the top of the mountain, and we start firing with them. And then come to find out there was their own outfit, so they didn't quit. And a couple of boys got shot.
Mm.
But then we found out that it was their men. So then from there, we stopped, and then we went into toward another town, I forget the name. Well, we were trying to take that hill. It took the whole division to take it after that. And we stayed there for a week or two on top of the hill, going to the Saarbrücken down there. Finally, we got orders to attack. So then when we went in, we got to go down below and then go on top. And they appointed me as the number one scout going into Saarbrücken. And we took Saarbrücken without firing a shot. You know, Patton had come around the left and went in on the precinct and bypassed Saarbrücken.
Mm-hmm.
And they took off. And we didn't have to fight nobody there because they had left because General Patton went in through there with the tanks.
Right.
And he saved us. And so we took the town without firing a shot. We got down there to the river. Runs right in between Saarbrücken. In the middle of the town, and they had a big wall, cement wall, 4 feet high, and we went in there, we all lined up and looked across the river, and we could see ladies, women on the other side, but no men, and no fighting. So we took the town, and later we found out why we took it without firing. After that, we stayed there and controlled it. Then we went into toward Frankfurt, Germany. We did some more fighting in a couple of more towns. We got into Frankfurt, and we was going to Berlin, but we didn't get to go to Berlin. So another outfit they went. So mm-hmm. We got as far as the other side of Frankfurt, and we occupied that. That's when the war ended. From there, they shipped us to Le Havre, France, to go invade Tokyo. So we got to Le Havre, France, and some of the outfits are already loaded in the ships and going that way, and we were still there, not loaded ship yet. So when they dropped the bomb, then it all ended. And some of the outfits were already on their way over to Japan, and they dropped the bomb, and then it happened. Then I joined the 2nd Infantry, and I re-enlisted. I would have gone to Korea with them, but I got out just in time. Korean War started in 50, and I got out in 48.
Mm-hmm.
I came home, and when I came home, my lieutenant colonel had promised me go back in 90 days. He was going to make me his sergeant major.
Uh-huh.
And I never did go back in 90 days. I met my wife, got married, and we married ever since.
All right. Well, I didn't want to interrupt you on any of that there, but I've got a few questions for you. So you talked about the incident where you got the Silver Star by taking out those machine guns, but that was just the beginning. I mean, you're over there in combat for 5-6 months before Germany surrenders. What was kind of the day-to-day life in that infantry division for you? Here you are, an 18-year-old kid. I'm sure you had to deal with some pretty bad weather at times, right?
Oh, yeah. The snow, rain, cold. And that's what's happening now. One of the doctors told me that I got frozen ligaments.
Uh-huh. Frozen feet?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Because we didn't have the equipment they have now, you know. We had to wear what we had, and we didn't have all the equipment.
And you grew up in Texas and Central California.
Right.
Had you ever been in the snow before?
No.
So the first taste of snow you have is with Germans shooting at you in the worst winter they've ever had over there.
Right.
And what did you have to sleep in?
You make your own, in a foxhole, you make your own.
You had to sleep in a foxhole,
foxhole
in the snow.
Right.
Could you even dig a foxhole, or was the ground too hard?
Oh, you know, we had to dig. We had to, you know, dig the hole.
Mm-hmm.
And put hay there, whatever it was. It always used to be two to a foxhole, you know, so one of them would sleep and the other one would guard. And that's what it was, really. It was cold and rain. Like they said, well, when did you shower? I said, you know, I don't remember showering. We used to bathe put water in a steel helmet.
Yeah, you probably used that steel helmet for a lot of things.
That's it, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine being 18 in those conditions. You've already been hit once, and just about every day you're out there knowing that you could get hit again.
Yeah.
How do you come to grips with that? How do you keep going?
Well, I don't know. And then it got at time at night. They sent us out on patrol at night. The captain called me in Saarbrücken, and he called me in and he said, how long you been a private? I said, it's the first thing we got here. He said, how you like to be a corporal? Oh, fine, yes, sir. He said, how you like to be a sergeant? Well, whatever you say. He said, well, a staff sergeant, you're a squad leader. I'm going to make you a squad leader. He gave me stripes for staff sergeant. After that, we left there. We used to send us out on patrol at night. And I had two Indian guys from Montana that were really brave. Well, I used to take them with me and patrol at night. And they wanted to go get a prisoner, get one or two, whatever. Those Indian guys, they would crawl and get up to where they were. And here they come with one or two, whatever, prisoners. And we take them back to the company and they interviewed them, you know. And they wanted to find out, and we used to do that at night.
That doesn't sound dangerous or anything.
Well, it was.
I mean, this is crazy kind of stuff.
Yeah, really.
Just find an extra danger out there.
Yeah, really. It was kind of scary, you know, but somebody had to do it. So after they made me a sergeant, they used to send me in and take whoever I wanted to. So I had this two Indian guys that used to go with me all the time, and an older guy and a younger man. And they were really brave guys. They were from Montana. I wasn't afraid with them, you know. They would take care of me.
With all the time that you were over there in combat, I'm sure that you had to deal with the loss of people that you knew quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, really.
Were you prepared for that? Was there anything that can prepare you for that?
No, nothing. You know, like right now, even though I wasn't fighting too much with the 2nd Infantry, but when I joined them, they went to Korea and they got wiped out in Korea. And in fact, some of them still there. The 2nd Infantry, where I was, 23rd Infantry Regiment, they got wiped out. And I would like to find out about the comrades that I had, because that's when I left the service out of Fort Lewis, Washington. I was with the 2nd Infantry, and I lost a lot of my men.
And we probably would have lost you had you gone.
Yeah, if I'd have gone, I'd been there, because I was a sergeant leader.
But so a lot of the guys that you trained with were killed over there, and their bodies have never been recovered.
Right, yeah.
And what about during World War II? You mentioned Sergeant Peterson, who was the guy who clearly believed in you, had you go along with them. The two of you together basically freed up that whole company to advance by taking out those machine guns. But you mentioned that he was killed. Do you remember when that happened?
That happened that same day that they got me. that same afternoon. When they shot me, it was in the morning, and they got him that afternoon. As I understand, I wasn't with him then, but they tell me that he got it three times. He was crossing the road, and a machine gun got him. He went down, and then artillery fire started coming in the building. The building collapsed right on top of him, and then tanks used to go right on top of him. So, and the reason I only knew him by Sergeant Peterson, because that's the only one I can remember, and I knew him because when I reported to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, he was the first sergeant, and I had to report to him, and that's the only reason I really remember his name.
Was that hard to swallow when you found out he'd been killed?
Oh, yeah, it was kind of hard because he was a brave man. He would, you know, like I say, he didn't have to be there with the men. He asked to be reduced to a tech sergeant so he could be with men. Because first sergeant usually don't go out and fight. They take care of the company. But he was first sergeant, and he has to be reduced to a tech. So that's why he got it. And it was really hard to lose him. He was a brave man.
Were there other times that you remember that kind of stand out to you where you thought you might get it?
Yeah, there was times. Like I say, you know, where you ever thought about it, I say, yeah, you know, you're scared. You're afraid. It isn't that you didn't want to do it, but you know, you thinking any time you could get it. It just so happened that I was lucky.
Do you have some examples of other incidents where something came really close or it could have been you? Any memories that you want to share?
Well, other times when we were going in, and all I can remember is that my buddies got it before I did, and I was thinking that it would be me any time. So, yeah, it was times where I thought maybe I was really lucky.
What do you do in that situation where you're thinking it could be me at any time? Do you try to block it out? Do you say a little prayer? Do you just, you know, keep pressing forward? How do you handle that?
The only thing you can do is just hope that it never happens, that's all. You start praying, and I know my mom was praying for me.
Your mom had three of you out there during World War II to pray for.
Yeah.
I'm sure your mother knew that you'd be in constant danger from the enemy, but how would anybody know that you'd have to watch out for your own American fighter planes? I understand you got shot at by P-47s?
Well, yeah. We're walking, you know, we're infantry guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, we going through the woods, and then finally we got out in the open, and we seen these 47s flying by, and 47s were our planes.
Yeah.
And we knew we had the 51s and the 47s, and so we knew it was our 47s up there. So we got there and waving at them and the whole bit. Then turn around, they made a turn around, and good thing it was a lot of trees and bushes around there. So they came around, turned around, and came back, and they start strafing at us. And come to find out it was our planes, but German pilots.
Wow.
They had taken them. And they came down shooting at us. Good thing we had to cover behind the trees and stuff. Otherwise, they would have got a bunch of us. And then they would get us. That's another thing that you never did know you were going to get it or not, you know?
You mentioned your mom praying for you. Did you ever hear from her during the war? Did you get any letters from home?
Yeah, she used to write to me. And I used to write a couple of notes to her. Well, you know, she had five stars, you know, five boys.
Yeah.
She was a brave woman, too. But, yeah, she used to do a lot of praying for us. Yeah.
I guess somebody was listening.
Yeah.
What was the hardest part of your time during World War II? What was the hardest thing to deal with?
Well, I guess the hardest thing was to kill somebody. You know, you're going to kill them or they're going to kill you. And I think it's kind of hard to say that. You know, you're killing an innocent man. They don't want the war either. You take, like, this one time going into Tribrook, and we go into the woody trees and the whole bit, and this lieutenant was in front of me, and I was in back, and I seen this German guy got up behind a bush, and he was going to shoot the lieutenant in the back, and the rifle jammed on him. He couldn't get it going. He was messing with it. So I saw him, and I got up, and I was behind, and so I let him have it. And lieutenant could never thank me enough for saving his life, you know, because he would have got him if the rifle would have fired. And that was hard to do, you know, shoot the man. It was hard, but it had to be done.
Did you guys, I guess you can only speak for yourself, but did you have a pretty clear idea of what you were fighting for, why you were there?
Well, we were there to liberate the country because Hitler was taking over. If we hadn't stopped him, he would have taken over I guess he wanted to control the world.
Yep.
And he had to be stopped. And we lost a lot of men. If it hadn't been for the U.S., we would have probably lost.
And the timing for you, you got there right as Hitler was launching his last big offensive.
Right.
You were right in the teeth of it.
Right.
In France.
Right. France, and you know, right there, and when I got shot in the belly of the body, it was like a forked deal town. Used to go all over, and it's the entrance into Germany. That's where a lot of the belly of the body was. They were holding that at all costs.
Had you heard anything about the concentration camps and what was happening there?
Well, we went through them, you know, where they gassed them and shot them all and all that. We went through a lot of them, and a lot of human smell. You could smell us, human smell, and it's awful.
Had you been aware that that was happening, or are you finding out as you're seeing and smelling all of this?
Oh, we knew that was happening, yeah.
They warned you, they told
you.
Was it empty when you got there, the concentration camp?
It was empty, yeah, empty.
But they took you around and showed you what had happened there?
Yeah.
It's probably hard to forget.
Yeah, it is.
You remember when you found out that Germany had surrendered?
Yeah, it was the other side of Frankfurt when you heard, and it was quite a party.
That's what I was wondering. What'd you guys do?
Oh, we celebrated. Had a lot of cognac.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. In fact, I right there where we were taking care of this town, in fact, I met this girl, Elfrida. She was a nice girl, and the people, the folks, they were all good people. They didn't want the war, you know. You felt sorry for them because, you know, they would do anything for you. They'd treat you like they loved you. Well, you cannot feel sorry for them because, you know, they don't want it. They were forced to. Like before we got there in the morning, we used to stay up on top of the mountain before we got into Saarbrücken. And a lot of times in the morning, you see white hankies coming in, walking to give up. And they were nothing but young kids, 12, 13 years old, and then old men, you know, old. They were giving up because they didn't want that. They told us that the SS troops, if they wouldn't do it, they would shoot them themselves. They want them to fight. The SS troops, they were mean rascals. That was Hitler's number one man.
Right.
And they were mean.
We're covering plenty of ground with Martin Madelin, and there's more to come, but it's time for another break. When we come back, how did he meet his wife of 68 years, Madeline? And why did he have to wait nearly 70 years to receive the Purple Heart? Find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 90-year-old Silver Star recipient Martin Medellin of Madera, California. He went to war as an 18-year-old who had never finished high school, but in the last year he's received his diploma, and just a couple years ago he finally got the Purple Heart for wounds suffered nearly 70 years earlier. His friends at VFW Post 1981 surprised him with it. We're going to hear about that, but first, you remember what it was like to get home from the war, get back to Madera, and see your family again?
We got into Boston, I think it's the 23rd of December, 45. I got home right at New Year's. Christmas Day, we spent in Chicago, coming home. We went downtown, got back on the train to come home, and we were really all happy to be home. And when we got to Camp Beale, I called my cousins in San Jose, and they came and get me. They brought me home, and I got home, and Mom was really surprised, you know. She didn't know I was coming. Yeah, and my dad.
Did you get some of those suffocating hugs where they don't want to let go?
Yeah, really. Yeah, it was really something.
Did they have any idea how close you came to not coming home?
No, they didn't have the idea, no.
And never. You didn't want to tell them?
Didn't tell them, no. I was really lucky. Even like yesterday, my wife was saying, you know, we've really been lucky. Yeah, thinking about all them things. Mm-hmm. Really been lucky, our family.
And you mentioned that they talked you into re-enlisting, so you're back in the Army. It's after the war, and that's when you met your wife?
Yeah, I came home on furlough.
Uh-huh.
Came home on leave, and that's when I met her.
Tell me the story. How'd you meet?
It was a friend of mine that came home from World War II, and he got married to a friend of my wife's, and she was a maid of honor. And this friend of mine invited me to his wedding, so I came, and that's when I met my wife.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I got out. Otherwise, I'd have been back in Korea. I would have gone to Korea if I hadn't gotten out. I'd really have been lucky, too.
I want to rewind a little bit here with you and ask you a few stories from stuff we talked about earlier, a few questions. You're in San Francisco when they attacked Pearl Harbor, right? And I've heard some stories about that. People were pretty freaked out there, and they thought the Japanese were going to hit San Francisco, right?
Right, right. They came close. I understand right there by the Golden Gate Bridge. Submarine came under close by there.
Well, and there's one that fired a few shells by Santa Barbara.
Right.
And then further north, too. In the months that followed Pearl Harbor, was there still kind of that scare going on?
It's kind of scary, yeah.
And I'm interested, your time at the shipyards. What all did you have to do to put those ships together? And what was that operation like?
They had assembly men that would put them together, and we would weld them, whatever had to be welded.
And you're doing that nonstop, pretty much, right?
Right.
Because
right.
They were turning those ships out crazy fast,
yeah,
at that time.
Yeah, fast, yeah. Liberty ships.
They still have one there. Have you been on it?
In San Francisco?
Yeah.
No, I haven't been.
It's the SS Jeremiah O'Brien. It's one of the Liberty ships that you guys built during the war, and it actually took troops to Normandy. It was there on D-Day, and it's still operational. They take it out. They have these. It's got that huge steam engine, and they take it out on cruises once a year around the bay. I bet they'd love to have you up there. They've got a little museum on the ship and everything.
I'll be done.
That's a pretty neat deal. So you could have stayed there. You could have kept doing that.
Yeah.
You had an exemption.
Yeah, I could have.
Why didn't you?
Well, like all my friends were going, and I figured, well, I might as well go too.
Even though it might get you killed.
Yeah, never did think about that. But even though I wanted to go and fight with them.
Mm-hmm. So you just said that you and your wife were doing this, but I'm just thinking about this here. So your first week of combat, you almost get killed. Plenty of other times the rest of the war. I mean, you've got those P-47s strafing you with German pilots in them. I'm sure there are a lot of times you didn't tell us about where the enemy was shooting at you.
Yeah.
And that if you didn't take them out, they would have taken you out.
Yeah.
But if any of those goes a little different, if that bullet on New Year's Day of 45 is a little inch off and gets your jugular, you never come home, you never meet your wife.
No.
Three kids, four grandkids, never born.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been closer, it would have gone a little lower, or gone upper. Yeah, it just burned me.
So an inch in any direction, really?
Yeah.
And you're gone?
Yeah.
How do you explain that?
Well, I can't. A lot of times I keep thinking about it now. Like I said, we've been lucky. I've been lucky.
And I know a few years ago, you got to go to Washington, D.C. and see the World War II Memorial.
I was there when they opened it up.
The day it was dedicated?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
204 when they did it.
Yep.
I was there. My son took me.
What was that like to be there? for
it
that.
It was really something, because three of the presidents were there. It was really something else. And I never could believe it. They took us all over, and they pushed me on a wheelchair. And a lot of the comrades used to come in the motorcycles and stop by and shake my hand and all that.
There are a lot of things to look at there at the World War II Memorial. I mean,
right.
I'm sure you found the pillar that says California on it.
Yeah. Number one, as you walk in the front gate, California is right there on the first one.
And I'm sure you saw a little storyboard of the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah.
But right in the middle, behind the fountain, there's a wall with gold stars, 4,000 of them.
Yeah.
Signifying 400,000 Americans who died in the war.
Yeah.
What did you think about while you were there?
I just thought about it could have been me, one of those, you know. But you don't take too much about us other than that.
Did you get your Silver Star while you were still in Europe? Did they pin it on you back there, or did you get it later?
President Eisenhower pinned this on me.
That's no big deal.
No.
So General Eisenhower pinned the Silver Star on you.
Well, the ribbon. He did that in Frankfurt, Germany.
So that was right after the war ended?
Yeah. You know, actually, just before the war ended.
Uh-huh.
But I never did get to have the medal until we got home.
But so you guys are lined up there, and a bunch of you get called for it, and the general comes to each one of you and pins that on?
Right.
What was that like for you? Here you're a teenager from Madeira, and the supreme commander is pinning something on you.
Well, it was really an honor. It was really something that it's hard to forget.
Were you nervous?
Yeah, nervous. Yeah.
I don't know if it's possible to stand at attention more or better than normal, but I would imagine that might be one of those situations.
Yeah, really. And then your Silver Star got your name in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Got your name in the back.
Did he say anything to you?
Oh, just congratulated me.
Mm-hmm.
Just say a few words, that's it. And not too much he could say.
So they gave you the Silver Star then, but they didn't give you the Purple Heart.
No, they knew to get the Purple Heart.
Even though you were wounded?
Well, yeah, see, that's why I said nobody knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, the only one I knew that got shot was Sergeant Peterson, and he got killed right away. The medic that took care of me, he hadn't reported either.
Right.
He was a field medic, you know. So he knew I wasn't really that bad, and really not too many knew that I had gotten shot.
Did you ever think about it over the years, thinking, you know, I really should have a Purple Heart?
Yeah, I did. I thought about it. But then they used to say that you had to be in a hospital or really draw a lot of blood. Never did think too much about it. But after that, I kept thinking, well, you know, I did draw blood, you know. It wasn't much, but I did. Other than that, there's nothing I could do. I met the gentleman, Michael, he's done a lot for me.
Because you pretty much gave up, right? You weren't going to do anything about the Purple Heart?
Right.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to do anything about it. Colonel Michael and Colonel Jones here, they had done a lot for me and got me going.
But they didn't tell you what they were doing.
No.
You had quite a surprise, didn't you?
Quite a surprise, really.
Tell me about that. You show up for something, you think it's just a regular dinner at your post?
Regular dinner.
And what happened?
And what happened, they called me up to the stage, and I was really surprised. He brought the medal for me, and he gave it to me, and I was really surprised. In fact, I started to cry, because I cry a lot right away, you know.
Nothing wrong with that, Martin.
Yeah, it was really something. It was quite a surprise for me and for my family.
You never expected that to happen, did you?
No, I never did.
So, you've been married 68 years?
Yeah.
So, if I asked Madeline what the secret to being married for 68 years is, what do you think she'd say?
She'll tell you she'd been lucky. In fact, she was telling me yesterday, she said, you know, we've really been lucky. I lost all my brothers, my folks. I don't have nobody else. I'm the only one that left my family.
What would you say is the secret to staying married for 68 years? You know, there's not that many people who can claim that.
Well, I don't know. I guess kind of agreeing with her, kind of agreeing with the boss, you know.
Yes, dear?
Yes, dear.
Uh-huh.
That's the secret.
All right. And you mentioned your VFW post, post 1981 in Madeira, the second oldest post in all of California. And nobody's got you beat. You've been a member of this post longer than anybody. So for almost 70 years, you've been a part of this post. How long were you in charge of that honor guard?
In fact, I still kind of in charge. I took it over when I was commander also. I was in charge of firing squad and honor guard, and I still have a lot to do with it.
So you've been doing that for how long? 40, 50 years?
Yeah.
How many funerals do you think you've been a part of? Hundreds, huh?
Quite a few.
Why do you do that?
It's kind of an honor to help especially the families, you know, of the lost them. It's kind of an honor to do that.
Have you had to deal with flashbacks, nightmares, or having those images from the war come back to you?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Still now?
Yeah, I still do. I think a lot of times I wake up and my wife said I kind of spoke her a little bit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about a lot of times I wake up at night kind of crying about it, thinking about my friends that I lost. I used to love to golf a lot. Now I can't even golf. And I lost all my golfing partners now, you know. They're all World War II veterans. And
yeah,
I lost them all now. I haven't golfed in 2 years now no more. But there's nothing you can do now. It's going to live with it.
You said anyone that says they weren't scared is lying.
Yeah.
Is there one moment from all your time over there that maybe scared you the most or took your breath away the most?
Yeah. Well, like I said, going into Saarbrücken, and I was number one scout. I could have been shot any time.
Because you don't know where they are.
No, I didn't know they wasn't there. But I was scared. I was thinking any time they could get me, because they usually get the number one scout or number two scout. And I don't know why the captain chose me to be number one scout going in there, but he chose me to go in as a number one. And like I said, I was scared because I was waiting any time I could get it. And it didn't happen. General Patton was quite a man. I would go with him any time.
Before I forget, I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, Martin, and thank you for telling me your story. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of?
I think I'm proud of what I've done and what I accomplished. I'm glad that it happened over there instead of here. I wouldn't like it to be here. If it's going to be that, it matter where it was, not here in the United States. And I would do anything for keeping it from coming here.
Mm-hmm.
Even as old as I am now, I would still fight for it not to be here.
I guess I should ask you, too, about this post. If you've been a member for almost 70 years, this must be a pretty special place for you. What have you appreciated about these guys over all these years?
You know, as long as we've been went together, especially the older ones, we have one of the best posts around. And we cooperate a lot together, and everybody just like a brother.
Well, and since we're recording this episode of VFW Post 1981 in Madera, we have a couple of those fellow veterans right here. So let's hear from them real quick. First, it's past Commander Bill Jones. How long have you known Martin?
I've known Martin, we met in 2002. I used to walk by his house every morning since 1990 when I came to Madera with my next door neighbor, Henry Shane. He was in the Army in the Battle of the Bulge. I was in Vietnam. So we'd walk by his house every morning to do our 3 mile jaunt. And this particular day, he's standing outside, and he says, "Hey, you two guys get over here." So he walked over and said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "I can see by your caps that you're military." I said, "Yeah, Marine Corps, proud of it." Henry said, "Army, proud of it." He said, "Did you see any combat?" I said, "Yeah, 29 months in Vietnam." And Henry was the Battle of the Bulge. He said, "How come you're not in the VFW post?" I said, "Nobody asked." He said, "Well, I'm asking, you know, get your butts down there." So the following Thursday, we showed up to the meeting. Like Martin says, the camaraderie here is just outstanding. You know, we don't sit here and drink beer and play poker and swap war stories. We served our country. Now we serve our community.
How he recruited you for the VFW. If we took a poll of the membership here at Post 1981, how many of them do you think would say the same thing, that that's how they ended up here?
Oh, probably half of them.
And what do you guys call Martin around here?
The General.
You've got quite a war story yourself from Vietnam, but when you hear his story about that Silver Star, what strikes you?
I think it should have been a Congressional Medal of Honor. You save, you know, 283 men, and you put your life on the line, then I think it should have been the Congressional Medal of Honor rather than the Silver Star. He's just a fantastic individual. Anytime I think about saying, "Well, I'm going to take a rest," he says, "I'm 90 years old. You rest after I rest."
He sets the bar pretty high, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And we really love him.
That is pretty hard to miss around here. And I want you to hear from one more voice. You've heard it on this show before if you're a regular listener. Mike DeCesar put in a lot of hours to secure that long-awaited Purple Heart for Martin because he thinks the world of him, too.
I met Martin when I joined this post in 2009. I heard his story, and I felt I wanted to help him. I helped him get what he waited so many years for. Although he wore the stripes of a sergeant, to me, he is a general. I was in World War II at age 16 in 1943, but I was in submarines, and I have the greatest respect in the world for Martin and anyone who put their boots on the ground in foreign soil. So to me, Martin, he may not be commissioned as a general, but to me, he is a five-star general.
Well, I know those words mean a whole lot to Martin Madellan, and it's nice for us to have that extra perspective, too. Find a photo of these three amigos from Post 1981 at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time this time. I'm Paul Leffler saying thanks so much for listening and reminding you again, as Martin Madellan knows oh so well, that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.